Support for this podcast comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Grand Budapest Hotel, the new comedy directed by Wes Anderson and starring Ralph Fiennes, Jude Law, Bill Murray, Edward Norton, and Tilda Swinton, in select theaters March 7th. From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. We are at the Chateau Marmont. My guest, Tim Burton, is thought of as being somebody who doesn't work a lot, but since his first film, Pee Wee's Big Adventure, in 1985, he's basically made a film every other year, if you think about it. Just the last decade alone, Planet of the Apes, Big Fish, Corpse Bride, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Alice in Wonderland, Dark Shadows, and his most recent film, Frankenweenie. That's just in the 21st century, Tim.
Oh, you forgot Sweeney Todd. Throw that in there.
I didn't forget them. I'm just throwing out names. Should we go all the way back to the beginning?
No. Let's not bring up past.
It's been so long. You're already correcting me. Thank you for this. But you do. You work a lot, and this is interesting because there's a kind of sense of anxiety that's often a part of your movies. I wonder if that happens to you as you're working, as you begin working again.
Well, no. I mean, I love working. I mean, I think my favorite part is the shooting of it. I mean, I'm not such a big fan of, you know, talking to the studio, you know, like a used car salesman trying to get it going. And I'm not, you know, a big fan of when a movie comes out necessarily. But there's fun, you know. That's, I think, why I liked Ed Wood so much. It reminds me of that's the process, the weird family, the kind of the weird filmmaking family that you get around you is something very special.
It's funny because you're talking about that, and I think about family so much. I think about the role that parents play in your movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, even kind of going back to sort of Pee-wee's relationship in Pee-wee's Big Adventure or in the original Frankenweenie, the role that parents play.
Well, obviously, parents are important in every no matter what your relationship is, whether it's good or bad, it's a powerful influence on your life. And I think I think no matter how you grow up and what your relationship is, you spend your whole life trying to kind of deal with your parents, whether they're alive or dead or whatever. It's something that makes you who you are, kind of haunts you forever, is a very powerful relationship.
But that sort of sense of parents really being a part of the lives, you know, starting with Big Fish in this last few years, Sweeney Todd and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, has really been a part of the movies you've made over the last 10 years or so.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, like, with Big Fish, I don't think that happened, my father had died just before that, and, you know, I wasn't particularly close to my family, but it hit me really strongly, and it really got me thinking. And I think, you know, I couldn't have made that movie before that happened. It sort of struck me in a very strong way, very powerful way. And it's interesting. I guess you're right. I haven't really thought about it, but I've been probably dealing with those issues more lately. And then really hit me lately when a producer and friend of mine, Richard Zanuck, died, and that still is something that's just haven't really come to terms with. It's a very powerful thing that you're never really prepared for. You know, even if somebody's ill or whatever, when it happens, it's just such a strong and powerful thing.
It's interesting you did Sweeney Todd, because it's almost kind of like this kind of operatic sense of loss sometimes in the movies of the last 10 years. I really find that to be the case here.
Yeah, and no, I love that movie, because I felt very strangely, you know, people say, well, which characters have I identified? You know, I try to identify with a lot of characters, you know, is it Scissorhands or Ed Wood or whatever, and, you know, those are all true, but I definitely identified with Sweeney Todd as well. I mean, there's something about his sort of interior nature and yes and no answers and sort of brooding and kind of internalization that I was just so much me in a certain way. It was so much the way I felt. And again, I think it's once you experience that thing, it does change you.
But communication, that sort of need to communicate, is really a big part of the movies, even though they're often, you have these protagonists who don't really say a lot or can't really express themselves. The need to communicate is key to the way these people operate, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think that's why I always liked, you know, like old monster movies, like, you know, where you see an actor do something without speaking, you know, and, you know, like Boris Karloff's like Frankenstein, and all the movies that he did were they're fairly nonverbal, but there's so much communicated, you know, there's so much coming through. And I've always enjoyed this sort of the mystery of that, because it's communicating, but it's still there's still a mystery to it, which I think is accurate. It's because oftentimes when people are talking, what they're saying is not necessarily what they mean or what they're really projecting, and words sometimes get in the way of actually what's really going on. So often that's sort of a criticism. Oh, your films look good, you know, but there's no real story. I mean, I've heard that my whole life, and the thing is, for me, the visualization is part of the story. It's part of the character of it. It's part of what it's about. And so I've never really quite understood that because, like I said, the movies I grew up on were, you know, I mean, if you look at a movie like Peter Lorre and Mad Love, I mean, there's moments, there's scenes where he's just, he's wearing a surgeon's mask in his eyes, and he's projecting so many things, and it's just like beautiful. And without seeing a mouth and without seeing anything, you know, you get this full story, which is beautiful. Projecting something very powerful without doing anything is amazing.
My guest, who's projecting his entire body right now, is Tim Burton. His most recent film, nominated for an Oscar. Congratulations again, by the way, is Frankenweenie. But in watching the current, if you'll pardon the expression, incarnation of Frankenweenie, reincarnated Frankenweenie. There's a lot of silence in that too, and that's the kind of the daring thing to me. It's a movie for kids. Well, I mean, there's certainly like noise and oral things going on, yeah. But there's a lot less dialogue in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, in some weird way, tried to treat it. And I talked with the animators and the DP, with the whole crew. We almost tried to treat it like a live action movie. I mean, because you know, with animation, you're able to do so many things, and you know, I mean, I've dealt with other animations, and your tendency is to go quite hyper and kind of quick and rapid fire, and we just felt it was more emotional, and again tried to treat the acting style and more like a live action film in the sense of, you know, not having things be too, you know, breaking the laws of gravity and kind of maintaining more of a sort of a live action kind of
given how
space.
Fantastic the premise is. The action in the movie itself is not that fantastical.
No, I mean, and we tried again, we just felt it was more emotional to try to ground it in a little bit more, you know, because I remember when we were in certain early storyboards, the tendency with animation is to just do things very, you know, hyper. And again, it just felt in this particular story to just bring it back to having the more quiet moments and like I said, treating it more like a live action. And also with the black and white, it, some reason it just, for me, made it feel more emotional and different.
But I guess, again, it's a story about a boy who finds a way to bring back this dog that means a world to him. What I find fascinating is, I think I'm always, and we may even talk about the last time you were here, I'm shocked when there's color in your movies. Because when I think back about the movies, they feel as black and white to me, it's kind of chiaroscuro, as they do color. Because you kind of like the fact that when the movies are mostly kind of monochromatic, we fill in the emotional colors as an audience, don't we?
That's right. And the interesting thing on this one is most of the kids that I've talked to, or people that I've talked to, after they forgot that this was in black and white. It wasn't an issue, which was great to me, you know, because you don't want it to be an issue. For me, I wanted to do it this way just because it felt right, and it was just something that felt right for the story and right for the emotion of the piece. So it was quite interesting to see that, you know, for most people, most kids, it wasn't an issue, which was great. If you deprive people of, like, say, one scent, like color, the other emotions kind of come out stronger. You know, you get something, and that's what I felt. That's why, like, with Ed Wood, I wanted to make that in black and white, because it was just, there was something about seeing Bela Lugosi in black and white which just made perfect sense in the whole Ed Wood vibe. And the same with this. It's like, it's, for me, I know, at least for myself, if it had been in color, it wouldn't have had the emotional punch that it has. And I think that's sort of depriving one sense to heighten the others.
But when you use color, though, I mean, it's incredibly deliberate. I mean, you think about the way you use color for emphasis in Alice, or the way you use color to sort of remind people that there's blood involved in Sweeney Todd, or the way you use red in Big Fish to remind people that life is passing by. You're very specific about the way you use color almost as an explosion anyway.
Well, I mean, I was very lucky, you know, at Cal Arts to have a design teacher. And, you know, that there are a couple of teachers where color, it's a part of it, you know, and I think understanding, you know, it's like why, you know, like designers will paint a room a certain color because it makes people feel a certain way, you know, or in butcher shops they display meat on a certain color because it makes it feel more attractive. You know, I mean, it's sort of a known thing where color, you know, is part of, and it can make you feel, you know, can give you an emotion. And so for me, I've always thought about it because, you know, using color or not as an emotional tool and as something that, you know, specific to each project, you know, each project you try to almost has its own palette and scheme that's a part of the story.
Yeah, but that seems to be, I mean, the fact that if I think about Beetlejuice, I don't think of it in terms of color. I mean, I think of splashes like, and even going back to, again, to Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I think about the way color is kind of used for you. It's kind of a mood setter as much as anything else, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And because, again, I think not only just for me, it's like, it's especially too, with actors and, you know, the DP and the designers, you know, it helps get everybody into the right mood, you know? I mean, in whatever the mood it's you're trying to create, it's an important element to sort of setting the scene. I think it helps the actors, it helps everybody, you know, because it indicates the sort of feeling and flavor of what you're going for.
Because I just find myself thinking the way you use Johnny Depp, for example, you basically don't ever really put him in anything that's that visually, with the exception of the Edward Scissorhands outfit, of course, that kind of visually conspicuous. I mean, you want him to emerge as a character rather than the outfit emerging and telling us how to react to him.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, again, it goes back to, and I think he understands this, that's something we've talked about, and, you know, because he's always appreciated, like, those old, you know, like Boris Karloff and Lon Chaney, and they were people that understood it, the full character. It's the look and the feel, and it's all part of the same thing, and that's why he's always so good at, you know, just being something different in each film. It's people that understand that every element is part of what creates the character.
Although it's funny because so many of us probably think of him as kind of being a sort of an alter ego for you. And in so many roles, he's trying to explain himself in these movies. He's, you know, in Corpse Bride or with the exception of Sweeney Todd and Edward Scissorhands. And even in Sleepy Hollow, these guys are almost like 30s romantic comedy figures getting in their way trying to explain who and what they are.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that probably just has to do with, you know, growing up feeling that way. I mean, I don't know, growing up in society, whether it was in school or whether you always, there was always this, and I think it's because, you know, when you were perceived as something different, you were always trying to kind of explain your way into the normal world, I guess,
really?
In some way.
Well, you had to do that?
I mean, even though at some point I kind of gave up on that, but you know.
What do you mean you gave up on that?
After a certain period of time, you know, people sort of labeling you as somebody strange or weird, it's like you just sort of give up and go, okay, well, if that's what you think, then there became almost a kind of liberation to that in a way. So it's like, well, okay, if you think I'm strange, then it doesn't matter what I say or how I dress or what I do, you know, you're going to think I'm strange anyway. So, you know, a certain kind of liberation came from that at a certain point. You know, you spend your whole life trying to become a person, and then in sort of Hollywood, you become a thing. And it's like, no, 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 no. I've spent my whole life trying to be human. I don't want to become a commodity or a thing or whatever. So that's why, you know, I've never really tried to analyze, you know, the stuff I do too much, like, well, targeting this or that, or it's for this kind of, it's going to be, you know, a successful movie, you know, you never know.
We'll take a quick break. My guest is Tim Burton. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm sitting down at the Chateau Marmont with Tim Burton. His most recent film is the remake of Frankenweenie. I have to ask you a question that you probably get a lot. For me, there's such a tactile feel to the movies. I mean, there's going back to the short Frankenweenie where you want to reach out and touch the bolts on the dog's neck to that brief stop motion thing in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I can name something in almost every movie we, as an audience, we want to reach out and touch it. I mean, how important is that to you?
Well, it's very important, and I think that came from, I mean, one of the first influences I ever remember was that of Ray Harryhausen, you know, who's influenced so many filmmakers, and for me, and I think
the
for
greatest
a lot of,
sort of basically stop action,
stop
animator.
Motion animation. He did, you know, Jason and the Argonauts,
and the Golden Voyage of Sinbad.
Absolutely, and even before I knew names of actors or directors, I knew his name, and there was something. It's just what you're saying. The tactile. You felt like you can feel fingerprints on it, and that's why I love stop motion. You know, and again, growing up like on the Rankin and Bass, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know, Mad Monster Party, those kind of things, where you just, you know, they're somewhat crude, but they're so there's something beautiful. It's like inanimate objects coming to life, and I think that, you know, as much as technology is advanced and you can do anything and amazing things with computers and all, you know, and I've worked with them myself, and there's amazing things can happen. There's still something that's just beautiful about that sort of tactile, and I mean the joy of being on a stop motion set where it's an actual set, you know, and you light it like a movie and the characters go in and out of light and you see a person moving it one frame at a time and then it comes to life as a shot. You know, I get excited just thinking about it. And, you know, it's an old fashioned technique. But then even the way the puppets are made, you know, they're just beautiful artistic creations. And you know, and if you touch them, they're exciting to the touch. And so, for me, it's still a beautiful art form. And, you know, for certain projects, I think in the case of like Nightmare and Corpse Bride and Frankenweenie, it was the right medium for the right project.
Because the thing about, I think, especially this version of Frankenweenie, is that it literally unleashes a sense of play. I mean, as much as it's about this boy bringing back this thing that means the world to him, it's also about the getting a chance to play with it again.
Yeah, and also, too, there's a real interesting joy to me because, you know, the puppets are somewhat crude. So the fact is that the motion that the animators could get out of these things that are pretty simplistic and like toy-like to me was amazing and also gave me an extra energy, you know, just to see, like, for me anyway, sort of pure emotion coming from things that are, you know, quite difficult and simplistic and crude to deal with. You know, sometimes it takes like a week to do a shot depending on the complexity of a shot. But the thing is, when you see it, and I think this is what keeps the animators going, there's just such a joy. You know, there's just such a, again, it's like frankincense, like it's an inanimate object coming to life before your very eyes. You know, it's not, you know, something you're doing on a screen and then it's on the screen. It's like you're there, you know, and they're moving it in the right, you know, dimensionally in a little set, and it comes to life. So there's a real energy and a real excitement that comes from that, to seeing that.
I think this also, it gives you a chance to really be reminded for yourself of filmmaking excitement, because we can really, I think we can feel it in seeing Frankenweenie.
Well, I mean, the thing is, no matter how, again, as I said, technology's changed, this technique goes back to, you know, even though there's certain advances.
The beginning of film, basically.
Well, yeah, it's like, it's, you know, one frame at a time. You know, it's, you see the, you know, you go back and look at early cinema, it's the flames flickering one and, you know, creating the kind of, you know, kind of thing. And that's exactly what it is. So it really hasn't changed very much at all, you know. And it kind of does, at least for me, kind of reconnects you to why you like making movies, you know. It connects you to those origins, which is the sort of purity of it.
I'm talking excitement and purity with Tim Burton. This is The Treatment, his new film. Most recent film is Frankenweenie. Again, getting back to that thing that I really like about the films is we want to reach out and touch them. So if in some ways, the 3D feels almost superfluous because we want to do that anyway. And I feel like that's a kind of a thing that you want to show that there's something sort of beyond the technology of filmmaking, that there's still a primal pleasure we can get out of the movies.
Well, definitely, because I mean, you know, I still gravitate, you know, and I every year, every so often, I kind of, You know, I go back and watch a movie like you know, the old Universal horror films.
But like The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, or any, you know, Frankenstein.
Go back to the James Whale stuff.
Yeah,
the
James Whale stuff and the Todd Browning Dracula, you know. And you know, I may not watch them for a few years, but that every time I see them again, I'm still surprised at their power, you know. And you know, like the James Whale stuff, the horror, the humor, the emotion, the stuff that he put into all those movies at once. I mean, that was very powerful to me, you know, mixing humor and horror and emotion and strength of image, you know, all in one thing. I mean, it was still, it's still kind of ahead of its time, you know. It doesn't feel old-fashioned to me, you know. There's something still very primal and powerful to those early films.
Can you show those to your kids?
Oh, yeah. No, my boy, he loved the Ray Harryhausen stuff.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he loves the, you know, the old Universal things. And, you know, the scary thing to me, my three-year-old daughter, her favorite movie was War of the Gargantuas. That was... I felt actually proud to be a parent.
It's not a very scary movie, but it's...
But, you know, she's the Green Gargantua and her brother's the Brown Gargantua. So
that explains a lot about your household.
Yeah, well, you know, actually at that point I felt, you know, like I was actually finally a good parent. No, but it was amazing to see that even with getting used to modern filmmaking, those old things can still be appreciated. So I was actually quite happy to see that, because you never know. You know, you think, well, this is too boring, it's too slow, it's, you know, there's not enough action and whatever. But they still have power.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Tim Burton about, and a number of things, but mostly movie-making excitement, which is clear in his latest film, Frankenweenie. I guess, though, I find myself thinking about the fact that you give as many entrances in movies as I've ever seen, which goes back to Karloff and Peter Lorre and Todd Browning and James Whale and those people who, I mean, they treated these things like they were stages. And you do that a lot, don't you?
Well, I mean, those characters were so strong. I mean, that's part of it, you know? It's like there's such strong images that just sort of, oh, there's Peter Lorre, or there's... I mean, that was part of the energy of the movies, you know? And I think that's part of the excitement of the movies, and that's part of the theatrical nature of it. And again, when you're dealing with a visual character, like an entrance or an exit is you know, those are very, very, you know, two of the most important moments sometimes.
But also, I mean, as much as those kinds of sort of horror fantasy things are, I still find myself thinking back to almost screwball comedy, in fact, yeah, pervades Frankenweenie.
Well, that's why I loved Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, because that mixed up both, you know. I mean, and when I was thinking about actually Frankenweenie, I thought, you know, well, I didn't want to just remake a short. And then I thought, well, I remember when they did like Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and they did like House of Frankenstein, where they put all the monsters in. And then, you know, ultimately Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And so that was, to me, was an amazing mixture of both the comedy and then the monsters. And you know, I always remember that as being a real classic example of both.
There's also this kind of weird, almost like everyday quality, like they have in the movies, where these things have to... Again, part of the thing about Frankenweenie is that for you it has to feel like it's this thing that kind of happens in the real world. And that's also key to the way these movies feel, like they're grounded in real places, first and foremost.
Well, I mean, that's why, in this, unlike the short with this one, I mean, with Rick Heinrich, we went back, and for me, I tried to actually look at real places, like in Burbank, and the memories of real places in Burbank, and like the way the classroom looked. And I mean, I remember thinking when we built the classroom and I looked at it, you know, in its final form, I got a kind of a sickly feeling. And I thought, yeah, it's right. I get it. That's how it felt, you know. And just the house, the bedroom, the park, the way things were. I mean, it was really important to kind of, for me, to capture that feeling of a real place. And you know, that was a very interesting, you know, emotional challenge on it, to really hit those things that were real memories, that, you know, in real places.
Wow, because even going back to the first short in Pee-wee, there's always at some point we walk into a room with them, which that makes us feel uncomfortable in one of your movies. As you talk about this, you reminded me of that. You do that quite often.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess I'm an uncomfortable person. You know, I mean, it's like, I think I grew up feeling weird in my own surroundings. So things that were deemed as normal felt abnormal to me. So that's why the whole word normal or abnormal never really had much reality to me, because you know, I've always felt slightly uncomfortable, especially in places that were sort of deemed as normal or you know traditional kind of places. They've always made me feel uncomfortable, and I've always felt more comfortable and somewhat more. You know, I remember people say, because I grew up near a cemetery, and I used to go walk around it, and I never felt like I was morbid. It just was quite peaceful, and there was something about it that, you know, I felt quite emotional, and it made me think, and it felt quite creative.
It was a place for a pose to go by yourself and think.
Exactly. And so it never felt like, you know, morbid. It never felt like it was something creepy about it, which was perceived as that. So I always had a sort of a contradictory a feeling about places.
Well, that sort of contrast between where people feel things are normal and that sense of dislocation your protagonists often feel in these normal spaces is kind of really another sort of integral thing to the way you make films.
Well, I think it was heightened by, you know, the growing up in suburbia where that sort of dynamic was very present, you know, the kind of the normalcy of life and the kind of wearing it like a badge. And I always felt uncomfortable with it because these people were almost like hiding behind what normalcy, which is nobody's normal, you know? I mean, they were as abnormal as anybody else, you know? They had their problems like anybody else. But to trying to hide it under this sort of kind of niceness and you know, behind the smile was not really, you know, a smile sometimes, you know, and not very tactile, you know. It was like I didn't grow up in a culture where, you know, people hugged each other or touched each other, you know. It was very kind of just slightly unemotional. I mean, there was emotion, but it was all sort of held back in reserve, and so I think you always sense that there was stuff underneath the surface. You know, unfortunately, it didn't come out. You know, emotions weren't really coming out in necessarily positive ways and, you know, tactile. You know, I think that's why I liked it, because I didn't, until I was in my 20s, if somebody went to hug me, I'd kind of flinch, you know. And so touching was, I think that's where the Scissorhands character came from. I got kind of freaked out because, you know, early on in my life, if somebody went to touch me or whatever, I just would kind of recoil. I wasn't kind of used to it. And so I think there was a lot of that kind of, there was that dynamic in the culture that I grew up with, which was kind of sad in a way, because I think, you know, there was emotion and there was love and there was things going on. It's just, it wasn't really shown outwardly.
It's almost like in so many of these things you've done that it takes like fear or death to bring out, is a way for people to deal with these emotions that they can't deal with under normal circumstances, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why, again, you know, growing up there, that also the one good thing about living in L.A. is close to Hispanic culture where, you know, like Day of the Dead things, where they explore death and things in a much more positive, you know, they explore it with humor and color and emotion. And, you know, to me, that was a much more interesting way, an emotional way, and for me, accurate way to portray things. It's not a morbid thing. I mean, it was always treated like a taboo subject and a morbid subject. In fact, it's a part of life, and so I think like certain cultures actually handle it better than in the type of time that I grew up.
That's why I thank God every day I'm not white.
Me too.
We're out of time, Tim. Thanks so much for doing this again. It's so good to see
you. Thanks to see you, man.
Our recording engineer at the Chateau Marmont is Will Bentley. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.